This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Celia Hatton, coming to you live from London. It's the first full day of the 47th President Donald Trump's time in office and the first full day of reaction to the initiatives he's already put into place. It's no surprise to many that Mr. Trump came out swinging with pronouncements that he wants to retake the Panama Canal and also declaring an emergency to stop migration across the United States' southern border. But it was perhaps the president's moves to withdraw the United States from the World Health Organization and the Paris Climate Agreement that have sparked the biggest international reaction. We'll be speaking about the climate agreement a little later in the program. For now, we'll focus on the WHO. Here's the moment Donald Trump signed the executive order.
Withdrawing from the World Health Organization, sir?
Ooh, that's a big one. So we paid $500 million to World Health when I was here, and I terminated it. China with 1.4 billion people. We have 350. Nobody knows what we have because so many people came in illegally. But let's say we have 325. They had 1.4 billion. They were paying 39 million. We were paying 500 million. It seemed a little unfair to me. So that wasn't the reason, but I dropped out. They offered me to come back for 39 million. In theory, it should be less than that, but, you know. And when Biden came back, they came back for 500 million. He knew that you could have come back for 39 million. They wanted us back so badly, so we'll see what happens.
Well, the UN's Global Health Organization today urged Mr. Trump to rethink his decision to leave, pointing to decades of joint efforts with Washington, its biggest donor, in fighting infectious diseases. Lawrence Gostin is the director of the WHO Center for Global Health and professor of global health at Georgetown University in Washington. I asked him how much the U.S. contributed to the organization and what its pulling out would mean for the WHO.
The United States contributes a little over 20% of the World Health Organization's budget. For over 75 years now, the United States has been WHO's most influential member and its largest state funder. We helped create WHO. The U.S. withdrawal, even in itself, is a severe blow, not just to the World Health Organization and global health, and it is a deep wound to them, but I believe it's an even deeper wound to U.S. national interests and national security.
Can you tell us more about that?
The first thing is that President Trump has suggested that he's withdrawing because China has too much influence at the World Health Organization. And I've worked at WHO for nearly 40 years, and I can say unequivocally that the U.S. has been a far more influential member of WHO than China ever has. But the irony is that this could cede leadership to our adversaries, and particularly to China. Whenever important decisions were made, like on a pandemic treaty, the United States would be on the outside looking in. And I think most importantly, WHO provides the United States crucial scientific data, pathogen samples, genomic sequencing data, surveillance and epidemiology that allows us to develop rapidly vaccines and treatments. The U.S. is used to being at the front of the line for life-saving vaccines. We now could be near the back of the line. I think this is a real own goal.
It is a tricky time for the organization, isn't it? I mean, just last month, the WHO was imploring China to share more data on the origins of COVID-19 without much luck. Is this revealing then the essential weakness of this organization, that it's so dependent on the cooperation and goodwill of some of its more powerful members?
Yes. The truth is that WHO doesn't have the ability to force China to tell the truth or to allow access to independent scientists on its soil. If we want WHO to reform, and I think we do, and we want it to be strong, member states need to step up and defend the organization. We've allowed this organization to operate on a shoestring budget without power and are throwing stones at it when we need to make it stronger. This is not a time for us to just be complacent. We need international cooperation. Germs don't respect borders. And the idea that the United States can go it alone with a pandemic or other global health emergencies like climate change is just fantasy land.
What's your greatest fear if the WHO membership becomes patchy or major WHO initiatives can't go ahead?
I think my greatest fear is that we won't have a capable, agile international health agency to be on the ground when health emergencies strike, whether it's polio in Gaza or Mpox in the Democratic Republic of Congo or Marburg in Rwanda or avian influenza in the United States. We need a strong WHO to step up.
Lawrence Gostin, director of the WHO Center for Global Health and professor of global health at Georgetown University in Washington. So how are Republicans feeling about the decision to withdraw from the World Health Organization? Let's hear from Congressman Rich McCormick from the U.S. state of Georgia. He's a physician, and he also has a global view after serving in the U.S. Marine Corps and Navy for over two decades before going into politics, with stints in Africa, Afghanistan, and the Persian Gulf. Does he think, like the WHO official we just spoke to, that the U.S. risks ceding leadership to China?
Let me first say that I'm not an isolationist. I'm a reasonable guy who's actually been a NATO parliamentarian, somebody who understands the benefit of having the United States influence on international organizations. The nice thing about NATO is we actually have controlling votes, and it benefits all of Europe and really stabilizes the world. The problem with organizations like the United Nations and World Health Organization has kind of been pilfered, and the United States doesn't get a credit for what we bring to the table. As President Trump just stated, we spend over $500 million on something that China spends $39 million and other countries spend much, much less on. And yet the result is we have lost control of our own destiny when it comes to disease discussion. Who controls the narrative? Who controls the science? When I say science, science should be based on science. Now, what we just saw during this pandemic, and I'm an ER doctor who actually served during the entire pandemic in overnight shifts, full time, and saw myself get censored by organizations that aligned with the World Health Organization that gave false statistics, false analysis of what was actually happening, a false guidance, and actually hindered our ability to find the truth, such as China, which you just mentioned. We already did succeed. We ceded control of China when we allowed them to cover up where COVID came from, what they did for gain of function research when scientists started disappearing. You can't tell me that we're being honest brokers in this.
Okay, but looking forward to a possible future epidemic or pandemic, would the U.S. withdrawal from the WHO leave the U.S. exposed? We've just heard from Lawrence Gostin saying it would hamper scientific data sharing and the U.S.'s ability to develop treatments, and also putting the U.S. at the back of the line for vaccines. Does this have domestic repercussions?
No, it's, you know, from a scientific standpoint, all you have to do is get a sample of whatever the leading virus replicate is that year. So in other words, every year we come up with, for example, let me use COVID as an example to compare to flu. When flu first came out, and it's called the Spanish flu because it was the epicenter, they thought, because they're the only country that is actually reporting it accurately after World War One, when everybody was devastated, they were neutral. Everybody thought they had more. It's just that they're the only ones honestly reporting. When you want to get a sample ever since then, when we've morphed the flu virus, we do everywhere from 14 to 18 different viral versions of that flu for vaccinations, because you gather those throughout the world. We don't need the WHO to do that. Same thing with COVID. Every year we're going to have multiple variants of COVID for the rest of our lives, by the way. It's never going to go away again. It's not hard to get variants of that by testing people in and around America as well as the rest of the world. That's not that expensive, quite frankly. But we want to have control of our own destiny. And quite frankly, we also want to have credit for what we bring to the table. When you bring $500 million to the table, you want the United States recognized as, you know what, these guys are leading the way to help the rest of the world. Why do we have to subjugate ourselves to false information?
You've mentioned the $500 million a couple of times. If Donald Trump could get a better deal with the WHO, would you support remaining? Does it come down to the dollar amount?
Well, it depends, too, on it. If we're going to be able to have control of what they do too. In other words, I don't want advancements in he saw what happened with the COVID virus and where it came from. And I'm thoroughly convinced it came from Wuhan, and that it was in that thing funded possibly by our dollars, quite frankly. We'll never know the truth because they've never come to the table. They've never been open. And quite frankly, it worries me that the WHO could actually be part of the problem.
Well, the WHO has been pushing China to share more data on COVID. But moving on, if the U.S. does go ahead with the withdrawal from the WHO, does the U.S. not have a commitment to global health?
We do. And I think we can be great partners, but maybe independent partners, so that we keep accountability, just like the United Nations. United Nations, and quite frankly, it's an international organization that we're a big part of establishing. But when you become anti-American or anti-Israel or anti-Semitic, or you start misrepresenting everything that we fund, we have to take a second look at that and say, is this worth it? Is this something we need to be part of? Or is this something detrimental to the United States that we're actually funding?
Congressman McCormick, is this the new normal in Washington, that each outgoing president will put out last-minute roadblocks in place to protect his or her administration's work, and then the incoming president will do as much as possible on day one to undo what was done in the previous 4 years?
You know, that's a great point, because I've seen it. This started really, in my opinion, back in the Obama era. President Trump did a lot of it, and then President Biden doubled down on it. When executive orders become the norm on the only way to change things, our government was designed by Constitution to be very inefficient and very ineffective, so it would never become more powerful than the people themselves. When you use the presidential executive power to get most things done, it's going to be undone by the next president. That's why it's really important for the legislative body. This is why Congress and the Senate have to step up to the plate and actually use this one moment in time to grab back power and to codify that in law, rather than have laws that flip-flop all over the place based on a president's whim. And it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat. We pride ourselves in balanced government and checks and balances that are unique to our Constitution that make us the powerful nation that we are, based on empowering people to succeed without the encumbrance of government.
Okay, Congressman. And just briefly, Donald Trump said he would bring law and order back. Was it right for the rioters from January 6th to be pardoned today? Or does it say you can attack Congress with impunity?
Well, I think part of the problem is that we never gave them their constitutional rights to a speedy trial. If you're going to charge them, charge them. If you're going to try them, try them. But how long has it been now? 4 years. 4 years, and these people still haven't received their trial. In that case, you know, we have laws here that protect people from that sort of prosecution. Either prosecute them or let them go. That's part of our Constitution also.
Congressman Rich McCormick from the U.S. state of Georgia. And we'll be hearing from someone who received a presidential pardon for his role in the January 6th Capitol Hill riots in about 20 minutes' time. Stay with us for that. There's lots more to come on NewsHour. Coming up, how thousands of concentration camp inmates were marched to their deaths days before the liberation of Auschwitz.
My mother was 5 years old when she saw the death marches of the Auschwitz inmates, and she remembers the clacking of the wooden shoes.
Other stories we're covering in our newsroom this hour. President Donald Trump is expected to announce a multi-billion-dollar investment program for artificial intelligence infrastructure. The head of Israel's military has announced his resignation over the Hamas attacks on October the 7th. And the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has said those responsible for a fire at a ski resort hotel, which killed at least 66 people, will be held to account. You're listening to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. To Israel now. The country's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, has thanked President Trump for lifting sanctions against violent settlers in the occupied West Bank. He said the move shows his deep connection to the Jewish people and their right to the land. Mr. Smotrich's words follow attacks by masked Jewish settlers on two West Bank Palestinian villages on Monday night that are said to have left more than 20 people injured. Mohammed's family house is near the garden center, which was torched by settlers. He spoke to the BBC.
If you was there last night, you will not hear anything more than screaming of the wives, women, and children. And at the end, we don't have anything to protect ourselves. But they have everything to attack ourselves.
Two settlers were badly wounded by police who said they were attacked with stones. Also today, the city of Jenin in the West Bank has long seen running battles between the Palestinian Authority and fighters from Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Now Israeli security forces have launched an operation to, as they put it, eradicate terrorism there. The BBC's Jonah Fisher is in Jerusalem.
So Jenin is a known stronghold for Palestinian militants like Hamas and Islamic Jihad, particularly in the refugee camp, which borders the main city. So the Palestinian authorities have for the last few weeks been conducting its own operations in the refugee camp. But today, the Israeli military went in with helicopters, drones, armoured bulldozers, looking for fighters from these various militant groups. From the accounts we've been hearing, eight at least people died. And we've had a statement from Prime Minister Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister. He called this a large-scale and significant military operation, and he linked what was happening in Jenin to the many other conflicts that Israel has been involved in and continues to be engaged in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Syria and Yemen, and said that what was happening in Jenin is part of the struggle against Iranian-backed groups who are targeting Israel.
And can we make a link as well with what's happened today and the man who has assumed power in the United States now, Donald Trump?
I don't think we can necessarily say that what's happening around Jenin is necessarily linked to that. We have seen violence from settler groups in the West Bank in the last day or so targeting Palestinian villages, and the move by President Trump to lift financial sanctions on violent Israeli settlers is clearly sending a message to settlers in the West Bank that, if you like, President Trump has got their back.
Have we heard any reaction from Palestinian groups to events in the West Bank today?
Well, Hamas has put out a statement, and of course Hamas is in a ceasefire, a young ceasefire with Israel in Gaza, but it put out a statement specifically relating to the West Bank, calling on a general mobilization to support what it called the resistance fighters in Jenin. Alongside this, in the West Bank at the moment, there does seem to be a greatly increased Israeli military presence. The sense one gets is that what's happening in Jenin is not necessarily just an isolated thing related to Jenin, that there is a much bigger military operation perhaps underway or about to get underway.
Also today, the commander-in-chief of the Israeli army announced that he will resign over the security failures linked to October 7th that led to the killing of 1,200 people by Hamas back in 2023. Does this resignation put new pressure on Mr. Netanyahu?
It does. I mean, it's not entirely unexpected. The relationship between Herzi Halevi, the head of the Israeli army, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has been strained throughout the conflict in Gaza. Interesting, the timing, really, that Mr. Halevi put out a statement today, as you say, accepting an acknowledgement of responsibility. The southern commander of the IDF also has tendered his resignation today with similar expressions of responsibility. What it does is it does highlight how the military here, the IDF, has been willing to reflect and to acknowledge that it didn't necessarily do everything it could have done to prevent those attacks going place. We have not yet seen that sort of inquiry being extended beyond the military to the political classes here.
Jonah Fisher. Learning to play the piano well takes thousands of hours of practice. And even then, many find their progress plateaus and they struggle to improve, particularly with very fast, complex pieces. A team of roboticists at Sony Computer Science Labs and the Neuro Piano Institute in Kyoto, Japan, found by strapping a robotic glove to a pianist's hand, they could control the player's fingers and make them move faster. It improved their piano playing, and that improvement was maintained after the glove was removed and even replicated with the other hand, which never wore the glove. Here's an example of the difference it made in speed exercises. Here's a quick excerpt of a musician playing before using the robotic hand. And And this is the sound of the robotic exoskeleton moving the fingers. And this is how the pianist played after the training. The work was done by Dr. Shinichi Fururia, who is a research director at Sony Computer Science Laboratories and director of the Neuro Piano Institute. He's been telling me how the exoskeleton works.
If you're a pianist, you can wear this glove, and then this robot can move your fingers independently and very quickly. After exposure to this kind of the passive finger movements, you can take off the glove, and then you can play the piano much faster.
How did you test it out?
Because we invited in total maybe almost like the 100 pianists into our laboratories, and then we tested. We asked them to play the piano. Also, we looked at the brain function before and after the intervention.
And can you program this glove to play music that these pianists already knew how to play?
Yeah. That's another advantage, because we are now working together with many good engineers. And they can program like the Chopin or Beethoven or whatever you want.
Were you surprised at the results that you did get? Because the pianist only wore the glove on one hand, but they improved with both hands?
Yeah, that was actually surprising for me. Usually, if you try, you are trained with only one hand, and this hand is supposed to be improving, I mean, in terms of the piano performance. However, maybe brain learned how to move the fingers by using this kind of the haptic information. And then this haptic guidance would be helpful to improve the left-hand skill.
How does it feel when you're actually wearing the glove? What kind of experience is it?
Because the movement is very complex and fast. So that's why all pianists started to laugh. new sensation, I would say.
They started to laugh. Fascinating. And then as the time went on, did they sort of relax into it?
Actually, they don't feel anything because the movement is very smooth. And then some pianists almost fell into sleep because it was very comfortable, like massage maybe.
In theory, could you wear this glove while you're sleeping and have your brain do the work while you're actually asleep?
Yeah, exactly. That's another very promising application of this device as well, because we already know that some neuroscience research says like that while you are sleeping, your brain is listening to some tones or sound. So that means our perceptual system is still active while you are sleeping.
And so, Dr. Fururia, what is next for this technology?
So this is also maybe helpful for the rehabilitation, like the stroke patients or dystonia, like the movement disorders patients. So this is one application. And another application is maybe this device can be also used for the esports or surgeons or other skills.
Dr. Shinichi Fururia speaking to me from Tokyo, Japan. Welcome back to NewsHour. Well, reports from the United States say Donald Trump is set to announce up to $500 billion in private sector investment to build artificial intelligence infrastructure. The BBC's U.S. partner CBS News says OpenAI, SoftBank, and Oracle will launch a joint venture called Stargate. The CEOs of those three tech companies are expected at the White House shortly. Let's hear more from our U.S. digital reporter, Mike Wendling. He joins us live from Chicago. Mike, what is known about this $100 billion investment?
Well, it looks like it's going to start with a data center in Texas, possibly more data centers throughout the United States. Donald Trump has really tried to boost private investment. He thinks that the U.S. is falling behind in technology to the rest of the world, and this would appear to dovetail right with his agenda.
How does artificial intelligence fall within his agenda? We know he's obviously very close to tech billionaires, including Elon Musk. We saw many of them at the inauguration yesterday. Is artificial intelligence really at the top of his agenda?
Well, you see this across a range of tech sectors, right? So it's not just artificial intelligence, it's cryptocurrency, it's social media. It's about, I suppose, the new frontier in the economy. And when we talk about artificial intelligence specifically, it uses a lot of infrastructure. It uses a lot of chips and uses a lot of servers. It's very data hungry. Donald Trump, if there's one sort of guiding star in his economic policy, it's that he wants infrastructure and industry and factories to be built in the United States. He doesn't necessarily worry too much about the nationality of the companies. He wants them built here, and he wants Americans to benefit from them in terms of jobs and the wider economy. So, this isn't the first such initiative that he's announced, and he will probably be hoping there's a lot more.
Are you surprised to hear that those three companies in particular are working together, OpenAI, SoftBank, and Oracle?
You know, the eyebrow-raising part of this is Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, has been in a pretty long-running feud with Elon Musk. And, of course, Elon Musk is one of Donald Trump's key advisors, perhaps his key advisor, depending on who you talk to. So who knows what Elon Musk will think of Sam Altman appearing and sharing some of the limelight on this announcement. There could be other companies that are involved in this deal, too. We're seeing reports that perhaps Microsoft and other companies might come in down the line. AI is now a boom industry, and there's a lot of money being floated around. So I suppose you could expect a lot more deals like this with different types of companies coming together.
Okay, Mike, thank you for taking us through that. That was our U.S. digital reporter, Mike Wendling, speaking to us from Chicago. Stay with us on NewsHour. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London. I'm Celia Hatton. Let's go back to that key moment 4 years ago, the violent storming of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. on January 6th. Donald Trump has now issued pardons for almost all of the 1,600 rioters who've been convicted or arrested so far for their involvement in that episode. The only exceptions are 14 of the ringleaders, members of the far-right Proud Boys and Oath Keepers who receive the longest sentences. They will get commutations, meaning their records won't be expunged, but they will still go free. Winston Pangeen is a former police officer who was on duty that day as a police officer at the Capitol. He gave his reaction to the pardons to my colleague Nuala McGovern.
A slap in the face to Capitol Police, DC Police, and other law enforcement who quite literally were assaulted that day. It's really an unprecedented thing to know that these violent felons who were convicted by a jury of their peers for crimes that were largely broadcast for all the country and the world to see are going to walk free and be returned to their neighborhoods. For me, I was punched in the face, knocked on my back, pepper sprayed, nearly stabbed by a flagpole. It's just devastating to me, and I'm sure for fellow officers who are still there showing up every single day, not just Capitol Police, but law enforcement across the United States who show up every day in service to their communities, you know, making sacrifices of themselves to better the country.
Some have said who support these pardons that the sentences were too extreme or too long, to put it very simply, that they were overly aggressive in prosecuting them and that there was political machinations attached to them. What would you say? You were there.
That is not true at all. I mean, you look at the over 1,000 defendants, you know, criminals, and by and large, most of them served less than 30 days, you know, if any prison or jail time at all. So the fact that, you know, the idea that this was politically motivated, somehow exaggerated, is completely false. I think you just need to look at the law and look at how unprecedented the events of January 6th were. Something like this had never happened in our country. You know, our Capitol had never been stormed by fellow Americans, had never been attacked since the War of 1812. So I think that it's very important that those who particularly assaulted law enforcement be held accountable for their actions. And now they're just not being held accountable at all.
So what does this mean for you, Winston? Is there an impact on your daily life from what happened that day?
I hope that this won't change too much. But yes, you know, I ended up leaving the Capitol Police 10 months after January 6th.
Because of that?
Not solely, but I do like to think that had January 6th not happened, I could still be very much working there today because I did love it. I loved most of the officers I worked with and getting to experience that history. And I'm very thankful for the opportunities. And I would do it all over again. But I fear, you know, what does this mean, not just for me, but for other law enforcement and other Americans? Do you really want these violent criminals returning to your neighborhoods? What message does this send to law enforcement and to America, Americans, and to the world of that is political violence okay?
Winston Panjin. Well, Brandon Strzok was a pro-Trump influencer who pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct at the Capitol building on January 6th and was sentenced to 3 years probation. He signed a statement at the time saying he had recorded a video of himself telling the crowd to go, go, go. But he now denies this video exists and says he felt pressure to sign the statement. He's now been pardoned. I spoke to him a short time ago and I asked him for his reaction.
I'm really happy, and I would say that it's given me a great sense of freedom because I was not guilty of the things that I pled guilty to. Like so many other people, I was put in a position where the Biden Department of Justice falsely accused me and falsely charged me with things that I did not do and basically racketed up a stack of charges that could have seen me potentially facing up to 30 years in prison. And they said, or this can all go away if you plead guilty to a misdemeanor, say that you did these things that you didn't do. For me, it was never a question of how do I win and how do I lose. You cannot win going up against the government. You can only try to find a path where you come out of the situation with as much of your life intact as possible.
In your own words, then, what did you do on January 6th? Why were you targeted then by the Biden administration?
Because I started a national movement in the United States called the hashtag Walkaway Campaign, which is the largest national movement of former Democrats walking away from the Democratic Party.
But Brandon, sorry to interject, but you are shown, there are videos of you at Capitol Hill on January 6th saying, go, 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 when people were entering.
That's not true. No, that's not true. If it is true, I would like you to post that video, please.
You did tell lawmakers, though, that you were deeply sorry and ashamed for being present at an event that sent members of Congress running in fear to evacuate a building. You were present the night of January 6th.
Yes, I don't deny that I was present in Washington, D.C. on January 6th.
And there are videos of you recording yourself chanting, go, 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 to those storming the Capitol.
No, there's not. If you feel like there are, I encourage you to publish those videos on the internet, please. I don't deny that I signed a piece of paper that says that. What I'm saying is that that did not happen and that video doesn't exist.
Okay, so you were there, and what was your extent of your participation in the event that night? I'm just trying to understand where you were and what you did.
Sure. So I was a scheduled speaker at a permitted event on Capitol grounds on January 6th. And so I was on my way to this permitted event to speak when I started getting messages on my phone from people who were watching on television around the country saying that they were hearing from the news that people were going inside of the building. And so at that point, I began shooting a video and I walked up to the east side doors of the Capitol. There were no closed barricades. There were no police officers, zero, present on the east side of the building. There were no signs telling people that they weren't allowed to be on the area outside of the Capitol where there were. And there were thousands of people there. When I got there, the doors, the east side Capitol doors were open and some people were trying to push their way inside. And I stood there for 8 minutes. And then a man came outside of the building, got on a bullhorn and said, they've cleared Congress. Everyone left the building. Move out, move out. And I immediately turned around and I left.
I wonder, you know, how raw are the emotions still? And how long until this becomes a footnote in the history books? How long do you think it will take until these wounds heal?
I hope never. I mean, I think after what has been done to so many innocent people, I hope that we never stop talking about this. I hope that it becomes a lesson in our nation's history that we never, ever stop talking about, because this is the closest the United States has ever come to embracing full authoritarianism and tyranny.
Social media influencer Brandon Strzok speaking to us after receiving a pardon from President Trump. We want to bring you a story now that sheds new light on an important moment in history. 80 years ago, in January 1945, Soviet forces liberated the biggest Nazi concentration and extermination camp, Auschwitz-Birkenau. But a week before that, something happened which is less well known. The death marches when SS guards forced tens of thousands of prisoners further west, away from the advancing Red Army. Amy Leibowitz lost some members of her family in the Holocaust. She's visited a Polish village which has only just discovered its troubling history.
In Bojkow's main square, by a large Catholic church, the local school teacher, Krzysztof Kruszynski, is pointing to the cobblestones we're standing on.
We collected the old stone and we put on this square, but we didn't know before that this is the silent witness of the Death March.
With Soviet troops fast approaching the extermination camp, Auschwitz-Birkenau, SS guards forced tens of thousands of prisoners out of the camp onto what became known as the Death Marches. One of them passed through this village.
This is original stones from the street where the prisoners was going with the wooden shoes. The people for sure from the village not only they watched the death march, but they heard this terrible sound.
And yet for decades, the story of the death march here was unknown to the residents of this Polish village, Bojkow. One of those who revealed this history is a German woman, Cornelia Stieler.
Dass es diese Todesmärsche gegeben hat.
She says, I knew all my life that there were these death marches because my mother was 5 years old when she saw the death marches.
Cornelia was born 20 years after the war. She has spent years unearthing her own family's history during the war.
Also, wir wissen aus den Zeitzeugnissen.
What we know is that at these death marches, people that were too weak to walk, that collapsed, were directly shot. That people that needed to go pee and had to go into the snow in order to urinate were shot. The next day, the streets were lined with corpses.
So why has it taken a German woman to tell today's Polish inhabitants of Bojkow about their history? Well, because until 1945, this village used to be in Germany and was the proud German village of Schönwald. Cornelia's family used to live in Schönwald, but days after the death march, like others, her family escaped further west, terrified of the advancing Soviet troops, and took their history with them. A few hundred people stayed behind to look after their farms. Some paid a heavy price.
Now we are in the front of the mass grave. It's the place where the bodies of the German Schönwald people, which was killed in 1945 by the Russian army. And now, in this place, we believe there is around 200 bodies.
Directly across the road from the main cemetery, where that memorial is, there's an asphalt football pitch belonging to the school where Krzysztof teaches.
Probably nearby this place is where dead people from the Death March have their own grave. We don't know exactly, but we heard that when the death march moved from the village, the bodies were still on the street, and the German community, they make very quickly funeral and they put the bodies somewhere here.
Now, 80 years later, thanks to the rediscovery of this history, the victims of the death march passing through the village are at last being commemorated with a new memorial inside the Catholic cemetery.
Es ist immer wichtig, darüber zu sprechen.
It's important in general to know of things that happened, of people that were killed, inhumanely treated, tortured. And if we look away, then it's like we're doing this a second time.
This place is for everybody. The Jewish can come and put the stone. The Catholic can come, put the candle. The other people can put the flower.
And you can hear more from this story from Amy Leibowitz on Assignment on the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour coming to you live from London. Let's go back to the reaction on those right out of the gate pronouncements from Donald Trump's new administration. We began the program by looking at the withdrawal from the World Health Organization. But in his inauguration speech on Monday, Mr. Trump also pledged to rip up laws to combat climate change while encouraging the extraction of fossil fuels. This was his drill, baby, drill moment.
Today, I will also declare a national energy emergency. We will drill, baby, drill. America will be a manufacturing nation once again, and we have something that no other manufacturing nation will ever have, the largest amount of oil and gas of any country on earth, and we are going to use it.
8 years after he first announced that he'd take the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement, Mr. Trump signed an order to do so again. Giving his reaction, the United Nations climate chief, Simon Steele, said that the world had been there before, but the move towards renewable energy would continue with or without Mr. Trump.
The world is undergoing an energy transition that is unstoppable. Last year alone, over $2 trillion was invested in the transition, and that compares to $1 trillion in fossil fuels. So the signal is absolutely clear that the transition has gathered significant momentum. We're here. Even though I opened with saying we've been here before, a lot has happened in those 8 years that have passed.
President Trump says drilling for oil will help make America rich again. Earlier, I asked Dr. Stephen Cohen, a sustainability expert at Columbia University in New York, if this was true.
No, we're producing more fossil fuels in America than any other country in the world. And our economy is already the biggest in the world. So we're pretty rich as it is. And it's not clear that there is a tremendous market for additional supply from the United States.
Will it help, as Donald Trump has said, bring down the prices at the pumps?
Well, if you oversupply, you will have lower prices. But I don't know why the oil producers would get involved in trying to produce more to make less money. That doesn't make a great deal of sense.
And how much will withdrawing federal support damage the renewables industry inside the U.S.?
It won't help, but I think the fundamental price advantage of renewable energy over fossil fuels has already been established. This is why companies like Meta and Walmart are the largest adopters of solar energy in the United States, because they understand the cost benefits for them of producing their own energy. So I don't think that it has a long-term effect. I think there will be an impact on morale and psychology. And so a lot of investment decisions in the private sector are based on those kinds of factors. And so there may be some pulling back from investment, but I think it'll be short term. And I also think that as large as the American economy is, it's not the only economy in the world.
Will Donald Trump's stance put the U.S. at an economic disadvantage on the development of renewables and that whole industry in general, in contrast to what's happening in China?
Absolutely. I mean, the Chinese government is subsidizing the production and the research and development of renewable energy. And if you would like to allow them to be the market dominators, you would have them continue to do that while you invest in the dying technology of fossil fuels.
So if we look at this as sort of a window of time, is the U.S. really missing the boat then when it comes to being able to compete with China when it comes to renewables?
I would say that our private sector technological developments and ingenuity and entrepreneurship will still allow U.S. companies to compete, but they'll be competing with one arm tied behind their back. I mean, I think Trump's idea is that by producing tariffs, you then close off the U.S. market to China, but the U.S. isn't the only market. And so China is going to be able to sell its technology to many other places that would be very happy to buy it.
So can you put this into context for us? How far ahead is China in this industry?
They're certainly ahead in solar cell production. But the United States is the place where, and often with federal research and development money, the new technological innovations come from. Where China seems to have an advantage these days is at commercializing the technologies that are largely invented outside of China. So I think that the strategy that Donald Trump is following is not going to be helpful, but it's not clear to me that it will really have the kind of impact that is now being predicted.
To what extent is there momentum towards the green transition at the state level in the U.S., even in Republican areas?
Well, you're seeing a lot of the Inflation Reduction Act investments in batteries and electronic vehicles have been made in red states. And more importantly, the private sector, companies like BlackRock that invest billions of dollars, are investing it in renewable energy because that's really the future.
You're saying renewable energy is the future as if it's completely obvious. So why is the Trump administration so intent on supporting oil and gas?
I think the oil industry has a very effective lobbying arm. They're part of his political base. There's certainly symbolic and ideological argument that's going on. I think that the effort to try to force the new technologies like electric vehicles on consumers has probably not been very effective, but a lot of this is symbolic politics. The real economy is undergoing a transition to renewable energy just because it is more reliable and over the long run will be less expensive. And after a little bit more time goes by, I think that's going to become obvious to everybody.
So is this really then just a blip? You know, the UN says progress towards renewables is unstoppable. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's sort of like my students don't have landlines in their dorm rooms. They haven't had it for a generation. The point is it's technology and the lower prices that are going to dominate. And it's really simply a matter of time until the transition is completed.
Dr. Stephen Cohen speaking to us from New York City. Well, as we come to this, the end of this edition of NewsHour, we're still watching for the latest from Washington, where Donald Trump is expected to begin a press conference on artificial intelligence infrastructure that's going to start in the next few minutes. I can see the presidential podium has already been set up. Check out the live page running on the BBC News website if you want to track that and our later radio bulletins on the World Service. But for now, from me, Celia Hatton, and the rest of the team on NewsHour, thank you for listening.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking, and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt
for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.